Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. What does food independence in Hawaii actually look like? We learn about an organization on Kauai that's providing a real-world model and coupling it with food tourism. We hear the song of a small bird that's known for its vibrant color on the Manu Minute. We also meet a shopper on the garden aisle who tells us why the high cost of living in Hawaii makes sense for him. And we take you inside Mark's garage. No, not the one in Chinatown. Mark Cunningham may be long retired from his lifeguard job, but he's still out there rescuing. We'll explain. Think marine debris. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, earlier this week, we brought you a story about a hui in Mauna Wili cultivating and protecting a large piece of agricultural land on Oahu. Today, we take a look at a neighbor island effort to combine diversified agriculture and culinary tourism to strengthen the state's economy as well as its food independence. John Parziali is the director of agroecology for an organization called Common Ground Kauai. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson visited Parziali on the north shore of Kauai to find out what agroecology is and what it means for our quest for food sovereignty in the islands.
Common Ground is a regenerative hospitality company. Really, our focus is on food as the great connector, trying to foster experiences for both visitors and locals alike to really experience what that is. I try to get down and get in the dirt here a little bit when we're talking about these things, because oftentimes everybody wants to see what's above the ground, but this is where the real action is.
Yeah. Dirt is the center of all of this, right? Soil, like, right?
Soil creation, absolutely. Do you want to take a walk over? We can take a peek at some of that. So the further we go down here, the closer we get to soil. You know, that's basically soil creation in real time right there.
Yeah, that coloration, that white.
That is the mycelial structure of fungi, again, breaking down. And this is like the most precious thing we do, and it's everywhere. It's the foundation. And then even you can see some of the logs that are here. So as we look closer and just with where these logs are, it's like you can just see that these logs are very much on their way to being soil, right? So, you know, in some areas you get in here and you can, you know, you pick up a handful and you ask yourself, well, is that tiny pieces of wood or is that actually dirt just yet? You know, is that soil? So it's basically, we're creating the conditions, the foundational conditions for living systems always, everywhere. You know, I like to sort of start with the premise that, you know, global agriculture is arguably the most destructive human activity on planet Earth. Certainly the biggest threat to biodiversity worldwide, biggest threat to freshwater systems, ecosystems. Arguably that's one of our most threatened natural resources. Of course, the climate impacts of factory farms with methane and tilling carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Yeah, not to mention the social and historical subjugation of people and cultures. As being part of a global sort of community of farmers, we need to do better. We have to do better. And I really believe that this type of agriculture is that. It is the work.
You know, on the one hand, it might be obvious, and for you, it's like in your skin, I think, at this point. But what is this type of agriculture? Explain it for like a lay person who's never considered it before.
I would just basically to sum it up as simply as possible is just this concept of farm as an ecosystem. And, you know, oftentimes we think of ecosystems as these pristine environments that people aren't allowed to be in. I like to bring that notion of ecology and include people. And really, it's not just the, you know, the farmers that are out doing pruning or harvesting or planting. It's pretty easy to see their ecological role. But I even like to, you know, blow that up and spread that out a little bit to include the farmers and the value-added producers. And even in our case, the visitors we have that come to learn about this agriculture, and just by them being here, their presence alone is really helping us to expand. Every day we're running the farm and food experience, which is, it's about an hour walk through our regenerative agriculture areas, the agroforest and adjoining areas. And then that culminates in a 4-to-5 course plated farm-to-table dinner that is 100% locally produced. Everything is from Hawaii. 95% of it is probably from Kauai. We're designing the systems of production here to try to make it so everything stays. Everything that we grow goes 200 feet away. And our chefs and our value people who are doing value-added things take everything that we grow and make make it delicious and put it on plates for us, right? So that allows us to be incredibly diverse. Our campus here is 63 acres. We've got about 7 to 8 acres under like really active production right now. There's about 70 species of plants alone in this area. Because really what it is there's a definite architecture. It does seem a little wild and things growing all over the place, but there is a definitive architecture in this planting. It allows for the fitting together of specimens in their climax form. There's a lot of research and development still happening here, and it's happening in real time, and we're noticing the interactions between different plants in different spaces with levels of shade and how the animals are interacting. So like an example would be, you know, these two breadfruit tree over here, you know, they're only 5 years old, right? But as they grow and as their canopies expand, they'll almost touch. And then in the center of them is this peach palm, which we've trained a central leader on. So again, that will be the canopy above the layer of these breadfruit trees. And that's the other thing, when you're talking about economics, for example, you say, oh, okay, how would you compare this to a breadfruit orchard, just a monocultured breadfruit orchard? So one of the things that you can look at in terms of economics around this is that in the same space of this breadfruit forest that we're thinking about, how about the fact that we have vanilla beans trellised on the low branches of this breadfruit tree? So in essence, if we looked at the number of breadfruits and we priced it out per pound of what this tree is producing in breadfruit, the vanilla that's growing on the tree that takes nothing away from the tree is probably rivaling the financial yield of this square footage, right? And we're not even counting this is an edible flower, this is taro in the understory, there's some perennial spinach, pineapple, that's a coffee tree, that's only about 10 feet away, so now we're getting out a little further.
But that's a great example, because vanilla is a premium product.
Absolutely.
And so your point is well taken about the possible financial yield, and you can start to see clarity on the possibilities there financially. But what it says to me is that it's so much more thoughtful, which means it's so much more time, right? Because if I'm going to plant breadfruit for just acres, this row gets what that row got, and I just keep doing it. But this requires the time and thoughtfulness.
Indeed. But again, I just come back to this notion as farm as an ecosystem. And if you have monocropped farms, those aren't ecosystems. There are no monocultures in nature, right? So if you turn your back on a system like that, it's not going to thrive, because it's requiring fertility from a 50-pound bag. It's requiring pest control from a sprayer. And ecosystems, on the other hand, typically when humans walk away from ecosystems, they actually get a little better. Nature starts to take over.
But like if you have one crop and you're concerned about some kind of invasive insect or fungus or something, you're much more vulnerable because that one culprit can come get it all, right? And here, you might lose something to some natural culprit, but you're going to lose that one tree, right? Not the whole project.
No, you've exactly hit it. Right? It's like, I consider biodiversity as our primary pest control measure. And it's just for that very reason. We grow a small nitrogen-fixing shrub called pigeon pea. I consider it kind of like the most valuable player in the young establishment phase of the agroforest. It provides shade. Again, it's a nitrogen fixer, so every time you prune it, it fertilizes. But one other thing that not many people think about is that when you plant it around a sensitive young fruit tree, for example, any kind of like flying beetles that come in run into that first. They nibble on the leaves, which we really don't care that much about. And then they go off and look elsewhere. So in other words, the strategies of using plants and diversity for pest control. And like you say, when you look at a monocultured environment, when you have whatever pest it may be, it basically, once it gets established, it has an entire area to do its thing, and it's become suited to that crop. If this system is going to scale to hundreds of acres, thousands of acres, we probably have to give a little bit of that diversity to, you know, maximize some efficiency. But I mean, really, I mean, if we went down from 70 plant species to 15 or 20, you would still have those interconnected systems that create resiliency, but then it would also be a more efficient system to manage on a larger acreage.
It's this clash between capitalism and agroforestry, right? Because there is something incongruous there, because sort of marketplaces and that efficiency you spoke to really sort of demands that the diversity get dwindled down. So I don't know, is there a sweet spot you can see as people think about scaling up, talking about that ambition for Hawaii to become more independent food-wise? And what does the model look like in terms of, in your mind, in your imagination, how the yield gets moved, gets circulated?
I think there's probably between 200,000 and 300,000 acres of agricultural land in Hawaii that could support agroforestry systems, right? So as we look to what is the future of Hawaiian agriculture, what is the, you know, how can we be more resilient? How can we make a dent in all the food imports? How can we keep some of that money here? There's efficiencies of scale that would help a system like this, yet we want to keep that ecosystem approach, right? Because those are difficult things to quantify, right? Like this idea that, you know, you have chickens feeding trees and trees feeding chickens, and out of the deal, we get eggs and breadfruit, right? So that's not an easy thing to account for, right? And then really, when you start looking at bigger questions of economics, when you start like really getting into the nitty gritty of how that looks, is you have to talk about externalities and things like that are woven into our system that just don't make any sense. I mean, how long are we going to really get away with destroying ecosystems and have that not be on anybody's balance sheet, essentially, right? If we're talking about profit and loss statements, how is the loss of a habitable world for our kids not being accounted for when agricultural systems come finish in an area and what they leave behind them is toxicity to a point where it becomes like a Superfund site, right, that taxpayers are cleaning up? Our goal isn't to be an island here, but it's to be part of an integral part of a local food system that is thriving and is strong. And I feel deeply connected to the space that I'm designing and that we're cultivating and really that we're learning from all the time, making mistakes along the way, but also seeing, you know, beautiful successes too.
That was John Parziali from Common Ground Kauai talking with HPRCW Gibson. You took him on a tour over the organization's 63-acre farm. To see images from that visit, check out our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com. Support for HPR comes from Monkey Pot Kitchen in Waikiki, Ko'olina, Wailea, and Ka'anapali, and from Moku Kitchen on Oahu, The Beach House on Kauai, and Ulu Kitchen on Maui, featuring live music nightly.
Welcome back to The Conversation. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. Today we've got a bird named for its brilliant color, the saffron finch. Special thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for sharing their calls. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The saffron finch is a golden-yellow songbird that can be commonly seen in small flocks on lawns and other grassy and shrubby areas on Hawaii Island and Oahu. Native to South America, they were introduced to Hawaii in the early 1960s, mainly because of their colorful plumage and their pleasant whistle-like songs. Both sexes are bright yellow, but males have a much more orangey head and face, while juveniles are much lighter yellow. They mostly forage on the ground for seeds and insects, and are also happy to visit backyard bird feeders. These birds were introduced at a time when many of our native birds had disappeared from the lowlands due to mosquito-transmitted disease like avian malaria. If and when we ever succeed at landscape-scale control of these non-native mosquitoes, it's possible that many of our native birds, like the bright red apapane and the yellow amakihi, can recolonize our parks and backyards. It remains to be seen how they might interact with some of the newly established species like the saffron finch. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Time Time now for a new installment of What's in Your Cart. We spent some time on Kauai where the conversation's D.W. Gibson met a shopper named Lewis outside the Big Save in Hanalei. He talked about what originally took him to the garden aisle, making ends meet, and why all the high cost of living is worth it for him.
So tell us about your shopping experience today. What did you buy?
I bought some milk. I bought some spaghetti for dinner for my kids and some ketchup.
And have you noticed anything on this shopping experience or other recent trips about prices going up, going down? Any changes at all?
Prices always go up. They never go down.
Are there items that you've noticed, specific items that you like that you buy regularly, like you're, this is way more expensive than it was at the beginning of the year?
Pretty much everything. At least 20%, I would say.
And how does that shape your approach to shopping? Do you change how you shop?
Yeah, only buy the essentials. There's nothing extra anymore for us. I have 5 people in my family. Three boys, so they eat a lot of food, so I gotta be careful.
That's a lot of calories. How old are they?
17, 8, and 12.
Wow, all right. So how are you feeling about the economy in general?
I think it's not too good, but living here in Hawaii, just gotta make the best that you can do.
Sort of, you value where you live, and you just try to make it work. It's a beautiful place, but an expensive place.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. No, just be careful what you buy, don't go overboard. That's about it. It's all good.
Do you think there's, to all the tourists that visit Hanalei, what would you say to them in terms of like the experience living here and the cost of living that people might not understand?
I think when they come here, they're going to understand it's expensive. Because when they come here, they know that already. If you're lucky, you can buy a plate lunch for $15, $20. Going out to dinner for a family of 5 could be easy $200, no problem. So there's cheaper places in the world, but you want to come here, that's what you're going to pay.
What kind of work do you do?
I'm self-employed right now. I live out by Waianae in Haina, across from the YMCA. Been living there for about 40 years or so.
What originally brought you there?
Warm weather, surfing, trying to be healthy, getting away from cold weather, that kind of stuff.
What cold weather did you escape?
Oh, I actually grew up in California, but I had to wear a wetsuit all the time. And that's not fun, taking a cold wetsuit on and off all the time. And I've been here with my parents for a long time when I was younger, since I was like 12. So I got out of high school and I moved over here at 18. I've been here ever since. Just working, washing windows, working at restaurants, hotels. Anything I can do to make money and get by, basically, and go surf.
Yeah, so it sounds like for you, the priority was really being here, and you just knew I wanted to be here, and one way or another, I'm going to make it work.
Pretty much. You try your best as you can do as a person. Whether you want to fly a plane or race cars, I wanted to surf and be in the warm water. I like being in the reefs and nice people around here for the most part. So, can't complain.
And that was HBR's D.W. Gibson talking to Lewis, a shopper who was outside the Big Save in Hanalei on Kauai. Where should we go next? Drop us a line at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training. R comes from Pro Arts Playhouse, presenting its sensory-friendly performance of The Reluctant Elf, a holiday cabaret featuring Maui artists this Saturday. Tickets at proartsmaui.org.
Hawaii waterman Mark Cunningham was recently inducted into the Swimmers Hall of Fame. These days, the retired city lifeguard and champion body surfer spends his time in the water looking for marine debris. His snorkel adventures have netted scores of everyday items, and he turns that trash into treasure, creating sculptures with a message. He recently took time out to give us a guided tour of his stash at his East Honolulu hideaway. It is quite the collection.
Yeah. Plastic pollution. It's our contemporary society, and here's the remains of it. And these all came off our windward beaches. Anywhere between Makapu and Kahuku, that windward side just collects it like a magnet and breaks my heart. But I occasionally incorporate this into art. Art, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. But when I incorporate it, it's to raise awareness about why is all this stuff washing up on our beaches?
I see down here on the bottom shelf, golf balls.
Bins and bins. Yeah, golfers like to hit their golf balls into the ocean. And I love to go snorkeling. And I find them. And what's so beautiful is you see how smooth this is because it's been rolling around on the bottom of the sea and it's been completely wet sanded. And once again, that's getting back to what I've said many times. I love seeing what Mother Nature and the passage of time does to these man-made objects of ours.
And you've got floats.
Lots of blue plastic floats, obviously. I'm investing in the future. I think these are going to be the glass balls of the future. And so I'm getting ahead of the curve. Joking.
You do have glass, bins of glass.
Big, yeah, this heavy-duty, thick glass that I found offshore Waikiki. I think it might have come from the old Waikiki Aquarium back in the day, unless a big boat ran aground there, or the old Queen Surf Entertainment venue that used to be there. Maybe they had big glass doors that broke and somehow got chucked out to sea. But I will mount surfboard fins on those on occasion. These are my favorite. I bought these in a secondhand store, and they're wooden floats with Japanese kanji on them. And I've had friends look, and it's the names of the family or the name of the company, but before glass balls, there were wooden floats. And after the glass balls, along came all these plastic and styrofoam floats.
And you've got just...
And I've got this crazy collection of rope. I'll do an installation one day of all of this. I call it industrial fishing gear. Most of it is when those huge trawlers are laying miles and miles of lines and hooks. Things wash overboard, things get chucked overboard, and they float and tangle up on the reef. And these are the ones that I find on the beach. And it breaks my heart, but that's part of it.
And you've got more golf balls more shells.
Baby abalone. What's fun about those, I found those, but not in the ocean. I found them at a garage sale in New Valley. It was a server from Michelle's restaurant, and Michelle's restaurant had baby Kona abalone aquaculture from the Big Island. And this server saved all the shells. Now I've got them.
That's incredible.
And what do we got over here? And here's some of my swim fins. Body surfing was one of my first loves with the ocean. And so these are just weird, unusual pairs that I have collected and hung on to. And then here's a garbage can full of fishing nets, remains of fishing nets. And once again, it's more plastic pollution and rope that just washes up on our shores and catches a lot of marine life and bird life and turtle life as it's the ghost nets, they call them. And they do a lot of damage to the environment. More styrofoam floats. Know where your poke bowl came from.
What got you started into actually creating art? You've just collected this marine debris.
Right. My mentor, my sensei, is a wonderful contemporary artist in Honolulu, John Koga. And John came to our house one day, and Katie and I had a pile of fins, but it was artistically put together of surfboard fins. We had a couple thousand in there, and it was about 4 feet tall, just held in place with gravity and strength. And John looks at me and goes, "Mark, you're an artist. Get busy." And I've been collecting these things for a long time. This is like the marine debris. I'll take you downstairs to the garage where the surfboard fin collection is. Okay. And it's that love of surfing of mine that really got me going. But all these things are gifts from the sea. I joke that I have fun four times with this whole process. The first time is when Katie and I can go snorkeling. We're in the ocean, we're getting pushed around, we're getting our exercise, whether we find any treasures or not. Doesn't matter. We're in the ocean having fun. The second time, as much as possible, I try to mount my art on man-made lumber that's been washed ashore and it's been has wormholes in it, it's been beaten up and weathered and what have you. Occasionally I find interesting wood on the side of the road too, but I like repurposing it. So beach combing, that's where all this came from, all the floats and nets, what have you here.
Off in the corner, you've got an aquarium full of
Nothing. Surfboard fins. Those are all surfboard fins. More where those came from. Third time I have fun is when I finally go downstairs into the studio, garage studio, and try to find a little rhyme or a reason or a pattern or what object is going to go on what piece of wood and how I'm going to put it together. And the third time I have fun, occasionally people give me money for it.
Now, you had your art on display somewhere earlier this year, right?
I've I was in a few stores. There's a wonderful little called the Cove Gallery out at the North Shore, run by some friends, right next to Foodland Shopping Center there. I'm not there anymore. One of my bigger venues is the Holly Eva Art Festival that happens every June, July, and Friday is set up. It goes Saturday and Sunday. But I've had pop-ups at R's Coffee Shop on Montserrat Avenue, Town Restaurant on Wiley Avenue when it was up and running, gave me one of my first shows. I kind of like going venue to venue.
Okay, and then you're going to take me down to the basement?
Yes.
Okay.
Down to the garage studio.
All right.
And that's where we try to make the magic happen.
We are here in your garage.
Yes.
And you have more bins full of stuff. So what's in this first bin?
Lots of stuff. This one here is the watch collection. And hands down, Casio watches are the favorite of swimmers and surfers in Hawaii. But they come off and straps or screws, things fall apart. And I have Timexes that keep on ticking sometimes, and Nixon watch, a favorite band with the surfers for many years, are in here. But I haven't counted them, but I'm guessing there are several hundred in here. In the next bin in the electronics department, we have some iPhones and other telephone cases. The electronic department rolls into the GoPro department. And lots of found GoPros. Lifeguards all around the island have been collecting lost GoPros from visitors for many years. This big box, and it is a big box, hundreds and hundreds of pairs of sunglasses that have been found underwater. And ones like this that are very white and crusty, obviously underwater and getting growth on them for a long time. And then sometimes you find them and they're just about brand new. And I've made several pieces incorporating sunglasses over the years. Snorkels, mask and snorkels, people lose, the waves knock them off, they sink, they can't find them. And I've got hundreds of masks here. I've got dozens and dozens of swim goggles that the swimmers lose and the waves knock off. My goodness, that's right next to the rice paddle collection, because not a lot, but a fair amount of rice paddles float and wash ashore on our shores. This is just a small bit of, these are like, I don't know, that marker stakes. When you're doing property lines or drawing straight lines on a job site or a construction site. And once again, these started floating in 2 or 3 years after the tsunami in Japan. And several of them have Japanese calligraphy on them. And they're strong and they're sturdy and they've been floating for years in the ocean. Then they wash up encrusted. Here's the bucket of hotel room keys. A lot of visitors go swimming and forget that they have their hotel room keys in their pocket. And I've got quite a few. And then surfboard fins, so many surfboard fins. I've got them organized by color, by style, by the company that made them. And I have thousands of surfboard fins. Surfers, screw your fins in. Very few boards have them resined in with fiberglass rope like they used to in the old days. They're two very popular fin systems, FCS and Futures, and they have these little bolt nuts that you have to tighten up. And if you don't, they wiggle loose eventually. You hit a rock or you run someone over, they pop out. What I really think pulls a lot of these fins out is the surfboard leash. If you've ever wiped out and had the surfboard leash around your ankle, you'll know, oh yeah, that could pull a fin off easily. These are crazy. It's a bucket full of Zoris.
Slippers.
What's crazy is that I brought these home from Indonesia. I went on a surf trip there to a spot called Ilan Garajagan, and the amount of litter on the beaches in Indonesia is just absolutely heartbreaking. They don't have the infrastructure to dispose of their trash, so it oftentimes gets chucked in a river and it washes out to sea, then gets blown ashore. But I'll make an art piece out of those slippers. Here's something interesting, Catherine. These are coring samples that I found, lava rock, basalt rock. I guess before they build high rises and certain structures, they've got to drill down and see what's underneath, how sturdy the sample is, and they pull up these coring samples. Some company chucked these into the ocean. They rolled them around and got this beautiful, smooth, wet-sanded feel to them, and
now
they're in Mark's garage. What are and
oh gosh, propellers,
props from boats.
Yeah, we have a few of those.
oh, maybe the drone belongs in the electronics department.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a few of those. This is a specific bin of windsurf fins. The windsurf fins are pretty unique and larger and more different than the surfboard fins. But we have quite a few of those. And then the wood that I put it on. Like I say, sometimes, as much as possible, I try to find it beachcombing where it's been beat up, weathered, wet sanded, so to speak. And sometimes I find it on the side of the road when a neighbor's tearing down a fence or put a set of shelves out there, and I find an interesting color, pattern, or patina on it. We have so much stuff in our contemporary world that I see value in all these things. Someone worked really hard creating the lumber, cutting it and shipping it and painting it. And for it to just sort of be abandoned, I see these things and I say, they have a little more life in them.
Yeah, but the more weathered, the better.
Yeah, as I say, I'm 70 years old now and I'm feeling pretty older and weathered. And so these things, the wood and these things that I find show that passage of time. That so many of these surfboard fins and sunglasses and electronics, they're brand new, shiny, under a fluorescent light in an air-conditioned mall. And somehow they ended up in the bottom of the sea, and I found them. And it's that proverbial dust to dust, ashes to ashes.
Talk about the message, though, that you're trying to underscore as you rescue these things and make them into something new again.
A lot of the marine debris, the plastic pollution, the nets and the floats, that breaks my heart, that industrial fishing that goes on to capture seafood for all of us to eat, that there's so much waste byproduct that simply gets chucked overboard, floats in the sea for years and years, tears up a reef if it gets washed ashore. Lots of marine life is getting tangled in it, and eventually it washes ashore on our beach, and then what? H power, I guess. Some of it gets burned, but there's just so much stuff in the world. So much opala, and so much of the marine debris isn't from Hawaii. It's from all the countries bordering the North Pacific. That North Pacific gyre just rotates around a strong current, and things, depending on winds and storms, it blows ashore on our windward shores on all the Hawaiian islands. Yeah, we've got to learn. I don't know what the answer is to use less and less stuff, or find things that are sturdier, or find a better way to dispose of things, as opposed to just chucking it in the ocean and out of sight, out of mind. I hope some young person is listening to this and can find a solution for us.
Basically, you are using your art in this stage in your life to help clean up the ocean.
That's part of it, yeah. It's a very selfish pursuit. It gives me joy snorkeling and beachcombing to find all these objects. And then the peace of mind sitting in this garage studio trying to find a little rhyme or a reason on what looks good, what fin is going to go on the perfect piece of wood. The simplest thing I can do is one fin and one piece of wood. And I will spend hours and hours trying to find just the right fin. Does it go this way? Does it go this way? Or does it go this way? Maybe this side of the wood is more, look at the contrast there. And it's just a meditative Zen exercise trying to find something that pleases my eye. And if others enjoy it too, terrific.
Yeah, it kind of saves your life.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I love, like I said, the Hollywood Art Festival is one of my favorite venues. And sharing it with the public and meeting friends and exchanging stories. And, of course, now I have people donating things to me. They see them and they go, this is cool, I'm going to pick it up, what am I going to do with it? And maybe Mark wants it. And
yeah,
don't tell Katie, but I've brought another thing home.
Most folks know Mark's garage in downtown Honolulu.
Yeah,
this
right.
is
Mark's
garage
times.
In East Honolulu.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest, Catherine.
That was a tour of Mark's Garage Studio with a bit of theater for the mind. To see actual pictures of the rescued marine debris, check out our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And Mark Cunningham says you can catch him and his art this weekend at the Holiday Makers Market at Jack Johnson's Kokua General Store on Oahu's North Shore starting at 10 a.m. Well, that's it for our show today.